All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta.
Well, good afternoon. This is episode 43 of American Vindicta. Today's date, January 17th, 2022. Today's topic, we're talking about occultism within Nazi Germany. Now, I have about 12 pages worth of notes to get to, and it's going to be interesting to go through all of it. Hopefully, we can get through all of it, but I have other messages for you before we go on to that. First off, I'd like to thank a new sponsor of our show, which is My Patriot Food Supply. Now, you can go to our new website, which is www.AmericanVindictaShow.com, and you can go to the sponsors page and find the link that'll go straight to My Patriot Food Supply. And it's a fact that the best time to prepare for bad times is during good times. When you know a big storm is coming, you prepare in advance. Same goes for our future. Things seem calm right now, so it's the perfect time to prepare for the next big crisis or disaster. That's why you should stock up on emergency food from My Patriot Supply. They're America's largest preparedness company with millions of happy, well-prepared customers. Their food kits stay fresh for up to 25 years. They're an insurance policy that you can eat, and when you need it, it will be there. You can shop dozens of food storage kits right now by going on to the link that's on my website. They're always having good discounts going on, and their kits give you an abundance of food totaling over 2,000 calories a day. And trust me, when times get really tough in post-apocalyptic America, the war will be as much against the enemy as it will be about retaining calories. You need a large amount of calories to give you that added amount of strength every day to resist whatever is happening. And every family member in America needs one of these kits. So please check out my show, AmericanVindictaShow.com. Please go to the sponsors page and get yourself prepared now while we still have the ability to prepare. And we'll be right back after this message.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
And we're back. This is American Vindicta. For today's show, I'd like to go over the epic amount of information there is on Nazi occultism, and trust me when I say that it would probably take me a whole week to maybe 2 or 3 weeks to really compile the generous amount of information that there is on Nazi occultism. The problem is trying to find historical accuracy within fiction and nonfiction, and trying to find something that's more than just rumors and speculation. So what I have found is the best that I can research so far based off of historical data. Now, there are plenty of people out there who can give you all different types of extra information. And I would suggest you please go and check those people out. But for right now, I'm giving you the extent of what I can find based off historical research. So before we get into that, the nature of nightmares, a realization of nightmarish past acts brought back from the dreamscapes of history. It's preserved by madmen and thrusted back upon us by the damned and the lost. Now, civilization has lived with atrocity since the beginning of the garden. Now, even with all of our many technological feats, we see the rise in barbarism again. And it's an era of technological barbarism that is upon us, better defined as technological tyranny. We saw how one group of elitists believes themselves as lords above the masses, and we are given examples weekly of the lengths that these elites would go to retain this power and control. Now, do not be distracted by this theater of politics. This is always about power and control. Either the elites rule us, or we, the people, rule this nation. Those are the only options. Every facet of life has been infiltrated at this point. Every weapon and technological advances that we have at our fingertips will be used to retain their power and sources of power. There are no limits of morality for these people that I speak of. However, we have a God on our side, and no matter the depth of the deep, the darkness will never shut out the light of God's people. And that is the one true God of Israel. With that said, our faith in Him, our faith in Jesus, gives me hope. Hope is a formidable weapon, and for the masses who refuse to be ruled over, our hope in Jesus brings us unity and strength. But how can it be that in a time when communists and socialists and Satanists and pedophiles have taken over almost every aspect of our country from within, that those of us who dare to defend our country and our biblical beliefs are now considered to be enemies of the state? It's more like we are enemies of the elite. Believers, my fellow brothers and sisters of Christ, fellow citizens of the kingdom of heaven, we are told that Satan goes around as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. We are taught in the book of Hebrews that they had the power to shut up the mouths of the roaring lions through their faith. This world's problems and its problem makers are just roaring lions. Shut them up through your faith. Be as bold as lions yourselves, and never back down in the face of the enemy. David did not back down from Goliath. Goliath was 3 to 4 times the size of David, and the mightiest warrior amongst the Philistine army, one of the many armies that were the enemies of God's people. And every man of the Israelites was terrified of this monster until David came. But David was walking in faith and in defiance of Satan. All it took was a leather cord and a smooth stone and the faith of a child, and the giant fell. Now Satan goes around as a lion, seeking whom he may devour with his lies, but he is no lion. He is an imitation of a lion. More the lie than the lion. Satan is no lion. He cannot stand bold in the face of the true lion, the lion of the tribe of Judah. Jesus, our King, is the righteous, and the lion and he is near us. He is here for us, and he is coming back. Satan has to convince this world through his lies and his deceits and his wonders to turn themselves against Jesus, thinking maybe this will overcome the glorification of God. The followers of Satan, they preach their occultic tongues and writings to the world everywhere and every day and all things, to include many churches, include many movies and songs, many video games and books. I mean, it's not hard for a child to just reach out and touch something that has satanic rituals on it now. You just have to be educated enough parent to look for the signs. It is our duty as citizens of the kingdom of heaven to strike this ground until the enemy is defeated, to go forth and conquer this world and tear down these strongholds, to leave no stone unturned. We are charged with bringing the good news of our Lord Jesus to the entire jurisdiction of heaven. With that said, consider this podcast as an intelligence briefing on the enemy. And may I introduce to you my findings on Nazi occultism. We'll be back right after this message.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, "You will own nothing and you will love it." And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have, access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position, really for the first time in our history. We're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer: Ready Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it, Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com, or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com, for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800-627-3809.
And we're back. So let's get into it. Nazi occultism. Now, you may be complaining, "Doug, why did you just have so many commercials right there at the beginning of your show? That was annoying." Well, I do apologize, but I have 12 pages of material to get through in about 40 minutes and hopefully make it sound interesting. So with everything that's going to be said, please do your research. Send this message out. Educate people. History is a weapon that we can still use against the enemies and the tyrants that try to rule us today. Please educate yourselves. Do your own research. Don't take everything that I say as gospel. But with that all said and done, let's get into it. The ideology of the Nazis drew on theories of racial superiority, but also found inspiration in Nordic mythology, paganism, and occult beliefs. Now, what we're about to go over is from Eric Kurlander, and it's a fantastic article. I'll cite it here right after we're done. But it introduces the menagerie of witches and werewolves and vampires that populated the ideas and even the language of Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, and Joseph Goebbels. Now, in Marvel's blockbuster movie Captain America, the First Avenger, which was in 2011, a Nazi officer searches for an ancient relic, the Tesseract, which reputed to bestow on its owner infinite power. In fact, Captain America contains many elements of Nazi supernaturalism, between occult forces, mad scientists, fantastical weapons, a superhuman master race, and magical relics granting the Third Reich unlimited power. That film was far from alone in broadcasting such themes. Even Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981 saw Indiana Jones racing to find the ancient Jewish Ark of the Covenant, again sought by the Nazis, planning to harness its reputed occult power. In the movie Hellboy, a comic book superhero who starred in two big screen adaptations in 2004 and 2008, and in certain computer games, was a demon that was summoned to Earth by the Nazi occultists. These are just three of the examples given. Pop culture has long been awash with images of the Nazi supernatural from the Second World War era, from comic books to 21st century video games, and from classical sci-fi films to contemporary horror movies. For nearly as long as many academics have dismissed such ideas as, at best, highly exaggerated, at worst, completely fictional. Yet, there is plenty of evidence of an important link between Nazism and the supernatural. No mass political movement drew as consciously or consistently on the supernatural imaginary, on occultism and fringe border science, and on paganism, New Age and Eastern religions, on folklore, mythology, or supernatural doctrines like the Nazis. The Nazis exploited these ideas and practices to attract a generation of German men and women seeking new forms of spirituality and novel explanations of the world, and explanations that sat somewhere between scientific verifiability and traditional religion. Now, once in power, no mass party made such an effort to police or parse, much less appropriate, institutionalize such doctrines like the Nazis. They were applied to the realm of science and religion, to culture and social policy, to drive toward war, to empire, and to ethnic cleansing. One cannot understand the history of the Third Reich without understanding the relationship between Nazism and the supernatural. Let's talk about paganism. On December 22, 1920, the Nazi Party sponsored a winter solstice festival. The festival was important according to the Volksheimer, which was the People's Observer, which was a magazine, a main newspaper that the Nazis used, because it would help restore racial and spiritual unity in the wake of the war, which was World War I, and the left-wing revolutions of 1918 and 1919. Now, the Renaissance and Aryan civilization symbolized by this solstice declared one speaker was prophesied by Nordic mythology and religion in ancient times, the, quote, National Socialist Solstice, according to Anton Drexler, who was the co-founder of the Nazi Party, was a visible sign of the return of German thought. Another speaker talked of Balder, who was a Nordic sun god, and pagan deities and other heroes, and the great history of Nordic mythology and the hero Siegfried, his birth in us, that is our solstice prayer, is a quote from that day. The Nazis did not invent the tradition of pagan German Christmas, but the organizers were indebted to similar solstice festivals revived a decade or so earlier by Guido von Liszt and George Lanz von Liebensfels. Proponents of the esoteric belief system dubbed Ariosophy. Now, the Nazis made good use of these pagan esotericists and their traditions in their attempts to sponsor a more authentic Germanic religiosity and an alternative to what they considered to be the destructive institutions and doctrines of Christianity. For nearly a decade, between 1935 and 1944, Heinrich Himmler charged a Hexen Sonderaufträge, which was a special task force on witches, or the Witch Division, with collecting archival material on the persecution of pagan religious practices by the medieval Catholic Church across Central Europe. The division assembled nearly 30,000 documents from various local and regional archives. Its purpose, according to Himmler, was to solve the riddle of how the dominant Aryan Germanic religion of nature could be defeated by the decadent Jewish Christian religion. Now, that's not my words, that's a direct quote. The SS witch researchers came to this conclusion that Nordic witches were the guarantors of the German faith and natural healers from the oldest Germanic sagas. By accusing so-called witches of consorting with the devil, the medieval Catholic Inquisition had criminalized and practiced a German religion and justified the murder of its then spiritual leaders. Such theories were taken one step further by the archaeologist Otto Rahn. Otto Rahn believed to have conspired plot lines and characters in Steven Spielberg's Indiana Jones films, and a 1933 book called Crusade, or For or Against the Holy Grail. Otto Rahn argued that the cup of Christ came from the Indian Mani, which was the symbol for a stone fallen from heaven, brought to Europe from the Himalayas by a white dove. Now, sponsored by Hitler and the SS, Rahn's second book, Lucifer's Court, wrote in 1937, went even further. In it, he speculated that the Grail lay at the center of medieval cult of Luciferians, literally devil worshippers, who practice a pagan Aryan religion drawn from Tibet and northern India via Persia, which is Iran. Accused of heresy and witchcraft, these last representatives of the Indo-Aryan civilization of Thule, or the Atlantis in Western tradition, had been eradicated by the Catholic Church, though their teachings were preserved by the Knights Templar and Tibetan monks. Otto Rahn's theories linked Tibetan Buddhism, Hinduism, and Indo-Aryan mythology with the paganism, Luciferianism, and witchcraft practiced across Germany in the Middle Ages, at places such as Brocken in the Harz Mountains, from the site of the Walpurgis Night scene in Goethe's Faust. This explains why many Nazis believed that Tibet was the home of the ancient Indo-Aryan people who had fled the destruction of their Ur-Aryan civilization, which was Atlantis, or Thule, after a series of floods. Indeed, though all of these Nordic and Indo-Aryan religious traditions, quote, seem to be going in different directions, as the historian George Williamson wrote, they served the purpose of forging a national religiosity that the Nazi regime wanted. All right, so we're going to get into occultisms and strange sciences. Now, not all Nazis were enthusiastic about occultism and paganism. In May 1941, Martin Bormann, soon to become Hitler's deputy, sent a memorandum to Nazi officials, and he's quoted saying, "Confessional and occult circles have attempted to spread confusion and insecurity amongst the people through the conscious dissemination of miracle stories, prophecies, and astrological predictions of the future. We have to be careful that no party members, especially in rural areas, take part in the propagation of political fortune-telling. Confessional belief in miracles or superstitions or occult miracle-making." Bormann was notably not a fan of the occultic society within Nazi Germany. And Bormann's circular invites the question that after 8 years in power and 2 years of war, why hadn't the Third Reich moved more aggressively to curb occultism? And the answer is that the Nazis themselves embraced many occult and fringe scientific practices. In order to refrain from scientific inquiry and improve medical practices, increase economic production, or shape racial and settlement policy, Nazi leaders sponsored everything from astrology to parapsychology to radiesthesia, which is pendulum dowsing. Now, Ludwig Stronach, who was born in 1879, was a Germanic mystic and Germanic revivalist, and most notably a pendulum dowser. He was an architect and astrologer, and he was used by the German military in the Third Reich, not necessarily willingly, though. Two of the more well-known mystics, other than Stronach, used in the Third Reich were Walter Schellenberg and Heinrich Himmler, who had a great deal of interest in Germanic mysticism and revivalism, where Wilhelm Gilbert, who was a pendulum dowser and astrologer, also notably liked Wilhelm Wolff. Now, Stronach claimed to have a special gift for map pendulum dowsing. And what they would do is they would take a string with some sort of object of weight underneath it, and then depending on which direction the string would swing is where they would start to get affirmation of what it is that they're trying to find. Now, Stronach would dangle a pendulum over a given map, and he would locate things. And as a test, German leaders of the German Navy requested him to locate the pocket battleship Prinz Eugen, which was then at sea. The Navy provided him with charts and were reportedly amazed that he was able to pinpoint the warship, even though it was on a completely secret mission off the coast of Norway. And this impressed the Navy leaders, and it impressed them enough to take the workings of the occult unit of the SS very seriously. Ludwig Stronach, was also the person who helped inspire the character Captain Jack Sparrow in the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. I'm sure some of you have seen that movie once or twice. According to Carl Spiesberger in his book Reveal the Power of the Pendulum, Stronach believed that brass was the most suitable material for all kinds of dowsing, and that even fruits such as apples, oranges, pears, and lemons demonstrated a polarity at each end. And in September 1939, the Nazi government gathered together physics and mediums and dowsers and occultists into an organization to assist the war efforts against the West, the Allies. They called this unit the Institute for Occult Warfare, the IOW, which Stronach was a member of. Now, Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels hired astrologers to produce his material. The parapsychologist Hans Bender's occult experiments were reported in major newspapers and sponsored by a Reich-financed institute funded by Hitler and Himmler. Hitler and Himmler's commitment to the bizarre doctrine of world ice theory, which claimed that celestial bodies made of ice determined the course of cosmic and human history, was powerful still. The regime even employed the occult-inspired biodynamic agriculture, which based on harnessing cosmic forces in the soil and the stars to prepare the athletic fields in Berlin for the 1936 Olympics. During the war, this approach to decision-making and policy helped facilitate projects that were both fantastical and monstrous. The Third Reich appropriated folklore and occultism and fringe science to justify military aggression and territorial expansion. elements of Indo-Aryan religion and Nordic mythology informed Nazi conceptions of geopolitics and efforts to cultivate alliances with Asian and Middle Eastern powers. Hitler himself took a magical approach to wartime operations. In attracting popular support and making decisions, he relied as much on intuition and faith as he did a practical assessment of the military circumstances. The propaganda ministry, the SS, and Foreign Office employed professional astrologers and diviners to produce wartime propaganda and to gather intelligence. The German Navy, for example, created a Pendulum Institute in 1942 to locate enemy battleships. And in 1943, after Mussolini was deposed and imprisoned, the SS gathered 36 occultists and charged them with the tracking down of Mussolini. These occult and fringe scientific theories were far from innocuous. It is no coincidence that the infamous SS doctor Sigmund Rascher was the son of Hans Rascher, a proponent of natural healing in biodynamic agriculture, and also one of Germany's leading anthroposophists, who believed that humans can, through inner development, learn to access a discrete spiritual world. Rascher, the younger, became one of Himmler's most odious acolytes, conducting terrible human experiments at Dachau concentration camp, where his father's biodynamic teachings were also applied to improve German farming in occupied Poland. The Rauschers epitomized the broader nexus between occult and fringe scientific thinking and Nazi racial science, which produced some of the worst crimes of the 20th century. All right. Vampirism. Yes, I said vampirism. In the summer of 1943, the Regional Education Office of the Nazi Party published a pamphlet with the evocative title, "The Jewish Vampire Brings Chaos to the World." Part of this propaganda series was that to view the Jew as a world parasite. The pamphlet argued that the Second World War was defined by an existential conflict between Aryans and Jews, who had propagated political and economic black magic for 3 millennia, and were quoted saying, wherever a wound is ripped open on the body of a nation, the Nazis propagandists would continue saying, the Jewish demon always finds in the sick place, like a powerful parasite from dreams. Now, that's kind of chopped up information that I just got. I can't read very well for German translation. But basically what they're saying in this pamphlet was that they compared people of Jewish society to vampires, that wherever Jewish people would go, that they would suck the life out of a society and then move on like a parasite. Now, this propaganda was not empty rhetoric. Nazi leaders genuinely viewed the Jews as omnipotent, supernatural monsters responsible for the devastation of the Second World War, as well as nearly every crime throughout history. In Mein Kampf, Hitler made multiple references to Jews as vampires and bloodsuckers and spongers, stating that wherever he appears, the host people dies out after a shorter or longer period. The Jew, quote, never cultivates the soil, Hitler added, but, quote, regards it only as property to be exploited. Through the most, quote, most miserable extortions on the part of his new master, the aversion against him gradually increases to open hatred. His blood-sucking tyranny becomes so great that excesses against him occur, end quote. After the death of his victim, Hitler would explain that the vampire sooner or later dies as well, which is why the Jews, he said, would always search for new healthy societies on which they could feed for a long period of time. Understand that Hitler is a very deliberately evil person. who, if you were a Christian, you would have to say that there is a lot of demonic influence in this writing. And do not buy the book Mein Kampf. Don't keep it in a library. Don't keep it as a souvenir. Do not have that devilish writing anywhere near you. So let's continue. For Hitler, killing just a few Jewish vampires was completely irrelevant. In that event, the chief result was that a few other bloodsuckers came into a job much sooner. That's a quote from him. Like an undead vampire, the Jew needed, quote, the smell of decay, the stench of cadavers, weakness, lack of resistance, submission of the personal self, illness, and degeneracy. These are all things that Hitler is using to compare people of Jewish descent to vampires. And wherever it takes root, it continues the process of decomposition. Now, no wonder Hitler remarked in December 1941 that he who destroys life is himself risking death, that the secrets of what is happening to the Jews, this destruction role of the Jew has, in a way, a providential explanation. The Holocaust was a part of a long-term pattern of European colonial violence against the racial other that was exasperated by total war. It was economic scarcity and virulent anti-Bolshevism. Yet the Third Reich, specifically their genocidal plans towards the Jews, were nonetheless more radical than those of other European colonizers, because the Nazis drew not merely on Darwin or Kipling or the Bible, but on supernatural imagery. And they shared this with Lanz von Liebensfels and other racist occultists. Only by associating Jews with vampiric, nigh superhuman opponents intent on destroying the Aryan race could the Nazis lay the conceptual groundwork for murdering millions of harmless civilians in so monstrous of a fashion. All right. Lycanthropy. Say that word with me. Lycanthropy. Werewolves of the Wehrmacht. Just a few years after the end of the Second World War, Oxford historian Robert Eisler gave a lecture to the Royal Society of Medicine titled Man into Wolf, which is an anthropological interpretation of sadism, masochism, and lycanthropy. Lycanthropy is the ability for a man to turn himself into a wolf, either by taking some sort of a potion or putting on some sort of a magic pelt and a tail belt, or to have been bitten by a werewolf. Now, a belief in lycanthropy, Eisler began, was prevalent across ancient and medieval Germany, especially in France. You can look up all the different episodes across France and Europe and Germany and Scandinavia back in the Dark Ages of werewolf-like events where there would be mass die-offs or mass murders or serial killers that were loose that were all blamed on lycanthropy, werewolves. This belief in the ability to transform into an animal, Eisler continued, had been resuscitated in the Third Reich, which employed the folkloric concept of the werewolf ubiquitously. Now, nothing could be more thrilling, Hitler suggested, than to see once more in the eyes of a pitiless youth the gleam of pride and independence of the beast of prey. Organized in wolf packs, he believed that they might hunt down and murder Germany's enemies in the dead of night. And Hitler urged his soldiers to fling themselves upon the enemies as in wolf packs. His headquarters in Ukraine was known as the Werewolf Compound, and his better known headquarters in East Prussia was the Wolf's Lair. The research institutes of both Himmler and influential Nazi ideologue Alfred Rosenberg produced reports suggesting that the incarnation of the werewolf runs through the Aryan and German fairy tales and naming conventions, and was one of the Eurogermanic characteristics of German racial spirit. There was no connection between the werewolf and Slavic Empire, though, or Slavic vampire, though. And vampires were linked in Nazi minds with Jews, and they were considered evil and racially degenerate. And werewolves, on the other hand, belonged to that rare group of heroes who could change into animals and could never serve the devil. As the, quote, dogs of God, werewolves were forces for good, defending the people against the evil and protecting their souls, an argument made by one of Alfred Rosenberg's subordinates in a dissertation. In fact, the Third Reich actively sponsored the republication of Hermann Lohn's 1910 novel Der Werwolf about a band of partisans defending Germans against foreign incursion during the 30 Years' War. In choosing the name of their own new partisans, Hitler, Himmler, and Goebbels made a small though important point with nomenclature. Lohn's Werwolf and the interwar Werwolf movement employed the term Wehr, which is where, a play on the German word for defense. Hitler and Himmler chose instead the more overtly supernatural derivative of the word werewolf for the name of their own paramilitary, a troop of volunteers that were recruited to operate behind enemy lines. As far as Hitler, Himmler, and Goebbels were concerned, Operation Werewolf constituted a core element in their vision of total victory or apocalypse. It was timed, after all, with the impending Allied invasion of the Reich proper and the rise of local militia movements in the East, where communist partisans carried out guerrilla warfare. They also carried out assassinations and sabotages against German occupiers. Even in the territory the Allies believed they had conquered, Himmler announced in October 1944, the Germans would, quote, constantly spring to life again, and like werewolves, death-defying volunteers would damage and destroy the enemy from the rear. Madmen. Absolute madmen. All right. Ragnarok of the Reich. The final opera in the Ring cycle by Richard Wagner, Hitler's favorite composer, is called Twilight of the Gods. The title was derived from the Old Norse myth of Ragnarok, the fate of the gods, which culminates in a final cataclysmic battle between the deities and their enemies. Drawn from the 13th poetry of the prose epic Edda, Ragnarok foretold a series of attacks by the giants of Jotunheim, the fire demons of Muspelheim, and the Midgard serpent Jörmungandr. In this terrible melee, Odin, Thor, and Balder, sons of Odin, would be killed, the earth and sky will be destroyed, and the sun will turn black, all because of the apocalyptic attack of the wolf Fenrir. Nevertheless, as foretold by prophecy, two of Thor's sons will survive the apocalypse. Odin's son Balder will return from hell, and the earth and humanity will be reborn. Now, in many different respects from the Edda, since Wagner's tetralogy was based primarily on the medieval German epic, the Song of the Dwarves, in which the dwarves Hagen and Alberic stood in for Edda's giants and fire demons. However, both accounts culminate in a final battle against implacable supernatural enemies, and both end the same way, with the Nordic gods and heroes consumed by fire and a message of redemption. This idea of existential conflagration, a series of battles that would produce either final victory or total defeat, became especially prominent during the last years of the war by the Nazi military. For most Nazis and millions of Germans, the line between natural and supernatural empirical and fringe science was always porous. Once the Third Reich entered a period of total war after Stalingrad, however, Twilight-inspired thinking found even more fantastical and violent expression. Such thinking was apparent in Operation Werewolf, and, more remarkably, in ethnic Germans accusing Slavic partisans of vampirism. Twilight inspired supernatural thinking extended into armaments and producing a desperate search for hyper-destructive, increasingly fantastical miracle weapons, including anti-gravity machines and death rays and massive missiles with no bases in material or technological reality. This also was an introduction into unfathomable engineering in the way the Nazis would try to produce these wonder weapons. And I mean, if you look at the train gun, that was this gigantic howitzer that had to be hauled around by a train. They had super tanks that were probably about 4 to 5 stories tall and at least a couple hundred feet long. And even to the extent that whenever the Allies started to invade into Greater Germany and they found some of these tank-making operations, they found the blueprints and drawings of these fantastical super weapons. Even some of the hulks of the tanks that were not completely constructed but were under construction. What if Germany had actually completed some of these wonder weapons? I wonder how it would have fit. I wonder how just violent the war could have become once the introduction of these wonder weapons started to come out. I mean, the V2 rocket that was Wernher von Braun's name to fame was one of these wonder weapons. Now, during the final months of the war, many Nazis and many ordinary Germans wanted to believe that death was not permanent and that fantasy was reality, that a, quote, magical priest such as Hitler or perhaps some new prophet might rescue them from annihilation. In this way, the regime's fanciful preoccupations with miracle weapons and partisan werewolves and Jewish vampires and ritual self-immolation functioned as a form of therapy for Germans who were suffering material and psychological distress, just like many Americans today or people around the world with vaccines and masks. Yeah, I had to throw that in there. If Twilight imagery helped Germans reconcile themselves to everyday violence, criminality, and loss, it also argued the disintegration of the Third Reich and Germany's post-war rebirth. By the end of the war, the myriad stories and prophecies and conspiracy theories shared by ordinary Germans were less likely to excoriate Jews, communists, or Freemasons than to peddle visions of retribution and redemption. Germans' final recourse to the supernatural imaginary was no longer about political domination or ethnic cleansing or empire building. It was much more the expression of hope and fear in the wake of the dissolution and destruction of the Third Reich. Now, this article was by Eric Kurlander, who's a professor of history at Stetson University in Florida, and he's also the author of Hitler's Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich, which was on the Yale University Press in 2017. You can find this at historyextra.com. Please check it out. So, on to the next subject of occultism. We have about 10 minutes left and 3 pages. Let's see how fast I can read. Let's talk about the Annenerbe. On July 1st, 1935, Himmler organized a meeting at the Berlin headquarters of the SS where he discussed his desire to launch a prehistoric research institute. Both Wirth and the agriculturalist Richard Walther Dahr were present and both responded with enthusiasm to this idea. The group was launched as a department of the RUSHA. Wirth became the group's president while Himmler took the role of the superintendent, a position entailing considerable control by placing him in charge of its board of trustees. Its formal goal was to promote the science of ancient intellectual history. The organization, the Annenerbe, was initially named the Deutsche Annenerbe Studienstaft The study for the the Society for the Study of the History of Primeval Ideas. But this was soon shortened to Anunnaki. This was a German term for something inherited by the forefathers. Its official mission, as told, was its first purpose was to reveal new evidence for the accomplishments of the ancestors of the modern Germans using exact science methods, which is a huge quote there. And its second purpose was to convey its findings to the German public through magazine articles, books, museum exhibits, and scholarly conferences. And according to Pringle, it is, however, in the business of myth-making, repeatedly distorting the truth and churning out carefully tailored evidence to support the racial ideas of Adolf Hitler. Some members of the Anunnaki consciously altered their evidence and interpretations to match Hitler's beliefs. Others appear to have been unaware of how their adherence to Nazi doctrine was shaping their interpretations of history. Now, the Anunnaki was one of these babies from Himmler, and Himmler regarded the Anunnaki as an elite think tank, which would sweep away previous scholarships of the development of humanity and reveal that Hitler's idea of the subject were true. Himmler also believed that the group's investigations might reveal ancient secrets about agriculture and medicine and warfare, which would benefit Nazi Germany as it employed scholars from a wide range of academic fields, including archaeology, anthropology, ethnology, folkloristic, runology, classics, and history, and musicology, and philology, and biology, and zoology, and botany, and astronomy, and medicines. Himmler believed that scholars active in all of these different fields would piece together a view of the past that would revolutionize established interpretations. In his words, it would represent hundreds of thousands of little mosaic stones which portray the true picture of the origins of the world. The Anunnaki sought to cultivate an air of professional integrity, and the Anunnaki became an integral part of the SS. And by 1939, the Anunnaki employed 137 scholars and scientists, as well as 82 supported workers, including artists and photographers and laboratory technicians and librarians and accountants and secretaries. Himmler used the Anunnaki research to fuel and justify the Holocaust. In 1937 speech at Bad Tölz, Himmler announced that the bog bodies of northwestern Europe, which testified to an Iron Age tradition in which individuals were deliberately killed and deposited into bogs or swamps, must have represented the eradication of homosexuals. This was an idea that he had adopted from Anunnaki archaeologist Herbert Jonkun. His adoption of this suggestion was linked to his homophobic fear that male homosexuality was transmittable and that it could spread within the ranks of the SS and other spaces of male bonding unless strong measures were implemented to prevent it. Himmler then claimed this alleged ancient tradition as legitimation for the extermination of homosexuals within his own society. As many as 15,000 homosexual men were rounded up and imprisoned in concentration camps, where up to 60% died. Amid the German invasion of Poland in 1939, the Anunnaki sent a team to Warsaw to remove any items from its museums which they believed to be of German origin. In 1939, the Anunnaki's further four planned expeditions to Iran and the Canary Islands off of the coast of Spain, the Andes, and Iceland were all indefinitely postponed because of the current war. At the end of the war in Europe, members of the Anunnaki destroyed much of the organization's paperwork, lest it incriminate them during future war crime tribunals. Now, we can also get into the Thule Society, which was another German study group. But more or less, the German Occult Society was founded in Munich in 1918 by Adam Glauer, who styled himself, like Rudolf Friar, Freiherr von Sebentendorf. God, I can't pronounce these names. This was an anti-Semitic society that had links to Adolf Hitler through German Workers' Party, later the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Their activities of the Thule group were as much political as a cult, and their sphere of influence included judges, police chiefs, professors, and industrialists. Dietrich Eckart, a central figure in the Thule group, also played a prominent part in the committee of the German Workers' Party and became one of the seven founder members of Nazi Party Germany. Now listen to this, and then we're going to have to close this whole thing out. When he died in December 1923, he is reported to have said, "Follow Hitler. He will dance, but it is I who have called the tune. I have initiated him into the secret doctrine, opened his centers and vision, and given him the means to communicate with the powers. Do not mourn for me. I shall have influenced history more than any other German." Now, everything that I've just read to you is about as historical fact that I can give you. Please do your own research. Trust me, this gets really deep when you start looking at Aleister Crowley and some of these other black magic stuff that was happening within the realms of Nazi occultism. I would suggest that you do read Empire Under the Ice from Steve Quayle, which will actually be a guest for us on Wednesday. And we're going to have him as a guest. We're going to talk about his book, and we're going to talk about his understanding of Nazi occultism. But as for that, ladies and gentlemen, that's all I have for you today. I hope you enjoyed our introduction into Nazi occultism. Please do your own research. Never stop trying to learn. And keep watch. It's only going to get darker. Ladies and gentlemen, this is American Vindicta. I'm Doug Ford. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord." End of transmission.